Okay, so first I would like to thank the organizer for inviting me in this very stimulating conference in a nice place also. So I will speak about some experiments and a little bit of theory that has been realized in Institut d'Optique in Orsay. So the main topic is about having single atoms in extremely small dipole traps. I will demonstrate that we can do that thanks to a physical mechanism that we call collisional blockade that I will describe a little bit in detail. So the work has been done by Nicolas Schlosser and Georges Raymond, who are two PhD students, Igor Protensko, who is a postdoc for theory, and myself. Okay, so I think everybody knows here about quantum information processing. The idea is just to encode and manipulate information on qubits that are linear superpositions. And here I will concentrate on a particular physical implementation of qubits, which is with atoms and photons. So for atomic qubit, we use typically two long-lived states that can be denoted as 0 and 1. For photons, we may use one single photon being in two different modes that can be, for instance, two polarization states. So along these ideas, there have been a lot of theoretical proposals that are listed here. We already saw that in Jeff Kimball's talk. If you are able to trap two individual atoms or ions at well-defined positions, then you can imagine many things. With two atoms, you can just couple these two atoms, two qubits, and you would get an atomic quantum gate. I will come back to that later. It can be even better to put these two atoms inside an optical cavity. This would improve the coupling. What could be done also would be to have quantum memories. For instance, you have a cavity with an atom inside, a photon comes, and it makes a change in the atomic state. So the qubit can be stored for some time in the atomic qubit, and then reshuffled into a photon which goes out from the cavity. One can also think about using atoms and nonlinear optical elements. You have the atom in the cavity, you have now two photons, and these two photons get coupled through the interaction with the atoms, and you can get a quantum gate between the two photons, a photonic quantum gate. So all this has been proposed, but this has produced much more theoretical paper than experimental papers so far. And the main reason is that if you want to do that efficiently, it requires an accurate localization of one atom, either with respect to another atom or with respect to a cavity mode. So if you just drop atoms in cavities, you can approximate all these effects, but you cannot do as well as you would like. So our idea is to find a method which is able to hold in place all neutral atoms with a very high accuracy. And the principle is to use a strongly confining microscope dipole trap. A dipole trap is the simplest possible optical trap. It's just a strongly focused laser beam. So recently, we were able to trap individual atoms. I will show that right now at well defined positions. This was published last June in Nature. And now we are working about trying to use our atoms to implement some scheme and to have it working, which would be the next step. So the principle of a dipole trap is very simple, in case you don't know it. It's basically just the result of the interaction, the coupling minus dE between a dipole and a field. A field induces a dipole on one atom. The induced dipole couples to the field, and this interaction energy creates an attractive potential, provided that the laser, which creates the dipole, which induces the dipoles, is detuned on the red. It's shorter than the atomic resonance. So this is the expression of the potential. It is proportional to the light intensity, I, and inversely proportional to the detuning delta between the laser and the atom. So a very convenient picture to interpret this potential is to speak about so-called dress states. If you consider the coupled system between the two level atoms and the laser, then this is a coupled quantum system. The level here and there repel, and then you get the ground level is downshifted, the upper level is upshifted, But since the atom is very weakly excited, it spends most of its time in the ground state, and therefore it sees this attractive potential, which is characterized by a so-called light shift delta, which is just this potential energy. So these are typical parameters for rubidium atoms, rubidium 87 that we are using. And the conclusion of all that is that due to the shape of this potential, if you just focus strongly a laser beam, then you will get a well in which you can trap atoms. The trapped atoms also will have a shifted level. So if you use a probe laser beam, this green arrow, then the apparent transition frequency will be shifted to the blue due to this light shift effect. So if we want a very small dipole trap, we have to focus very strongly. And for doing that, we design a very special microscope objective, which has the size of a photographic objective. It's about 15 centimeters long, that thing. But it focuses down to a submicron spot. And it's a little bit complicated because it was designed to be fit in a UHV ultra high vacuum chamber, so it can be baked and it does not outgas and it has all kinds of nice properties. And so the idea is that if you, this objective can be characterized by a so-called point spread function, which is the image, the smallest image that it can do, and the width here is 0.7 micron. This corresponds to a numerical aperture of 0.7, which is a 90-degree aperture angle of the beam here. So the light enters here. It goes big inside the objective, and it's focused here down to 0.7 micron. So this objective is in the this focal point is in the middle of a magneto-optical trap. I will see the design. You will see the design later. And these are the coils for the magneto-optical trap. So this is a whole setup. Here is this objective. Here there are some beams, the green lines, which creates a magneto-optical trap, which is able to make a little cloud of cold atoms, about 1 million, 10 million cold atoms, close to the focus of the objective. Then we put some light in the dipole traps, which is brought by an optical fiber from a TISAF laser. So this is this red light. It enters the objective, and it is focused here. So since this dipole beam is very strongly detuned, we will not get fluorescence from that beam, but we get a lot of fluorescence from the beams of the magneto-optical trap, which also cool the atom. So it's very convenient because the light we use to see the atoms is the same light, the green light here, which is used to cool them. So it's some kind of, there is no heating due to the observation. So the atom stays there. So to see it, we use something like that. This fluorescence from the MOT light is collected by the same objective, which is now really used as a microscope. And it goes to the CCD camera. So we have to get rid from the big light here, not that big, actually. And we use interference filter. There is also some stray light that we can filter using some holes. Well, this is just optical tricks. So now if we do all that, yes, some parameters. So the typical dipole trap power are a few milliwatts, which makes about 1 megawatt per square centimeter at the atom site, just because it's so strongly focused. So we are strongly detuned. It's the so-called fourth far off resonance regime. So these are the level scheme. These are hyperfine ground state. This is the one which is used for the magneto-optical trap. This is a so-called repumper beam, which is able to bring back atoms that get lost here. And this is a dipole trap, which is strongly detuned. So from the point of view of the dipole trap, both hyperfine levels here are trapped exactly the same way. They see the same potential. What else? Yes, a typical depth of the well is, depending on the laser power, between 1 and 15 millikelvin. So if we have everything running, what do we see on the CCD camera? We see a little bright dot. And given our imaging system, the size of this bright spot is 1 micron. So there is something which is 1 micron in size and which is shining in the trap. So if we look at if we evaluate the number of counts, we get about 10,000 counts, which means that it corresponds to the fluorescence of about one atom. But here, there is a trouble that with a CCD camera, it's a pretty slow device, and we cannot really follow what's going on. So what we did was to add something which is very convenient. which is to have an avalanche photodiode which works in the photon counting mode and which looks only at this red spot. So there is a pinhole here which looks at the little red spot, and now we can see in real time the evolution of this red spot. And what we did after that is just to decrease the number of atoms that comes in the trap. This is a typical loading sequence, just to see how it operates. This is what we see on the photon counting diode. So here there is some light level, it's a number of photo counts of detected photons, corresponding to no dipole trap. Here we turn on the dipole trap, so the red spot shines up. Here it's on. And here we turn off the dipole trap, and we see a big peak here, and back to the MOT. So what's going on there? This is simple to understand. Here we load the trap, so we have some atoms, I will say later how many atoms, which are in the trap, but as I said before, they are also strongly detuned by the light shift. So they do not fluoresce that much just because of these light shifts. And when we turn off the trap, the dipole trap, the atoms are just back to resonance, but they are still here. So there is a very sharp peak here, which corresponds to the time for this little cloud to go to move by 1 micron, after what they are just lost. So this is just the atom back to resonance. It's fully consistent with what I said before. So now if we move to a very weak loading regime, where we have basically no magnetic field in the magneto-optical trap, only cooling beams, and we count a significant time. So we count each step of this curve. It is a 10 millisecond counting time. What we see are steps. So we see here is a number of counts per millisecond, which is small. Then it goes up, then small again, and so on. And if we evaluate the on time here, it just corresponds to the fluorescence of one atom. So we attribute these steps to single atoms jumping in and out of the trap. And you see the time scale here is seconds, it's not milliseconds like in Jeff Kimball's talk, which means that we keep atoms for times which are very long, up to 10, 20 seconds when everything is adjusted. So the typical fluorescence rate per atom that we can see really now in real time is 8,000 photons per second per atom, which means that here each step is 1 millisecond. No, it's 10 milliseconds, so we see, you see the signal to noise ratio is very high. We are very quickly able to see that one atom is there. So once everything is adjusted, we can even see that on the CCD camera. And this little red dot actually blink. And when the atom is there, we see something. Where it's not there, we see nothing clearly. And to get a feeling of what's going on, this is a real-time movie of the running experiment. So there, here you see the atoms, it goes away, another come, and this is real time. So it gives a feeling of what's going on. So don't conclude that a single atom is a square. It's just because the fluorescence is matched to a single pixel of the CCD camera that it appears as a square peak, obviously. Okay. So an interesting question now is, we see one atom here. So that is when we look at these steps that I saw before, it was either 0 or 1. But why not 2? And this can be done more carefully. One can just make an histogram of the fluorescence level. So this is now a count rate, which is horizontal. And here is a number of samples corresponding to that count rate. So without the trap, we get a peak here, which is the background level. It corresponds basically to stray light. When the dipole trap is here, we have either that peak corresponding to 0 atom or that one, which corresponds to 1 atom. But clearly, there is no second 2-atom peak here. And this can even be more precise. That is, one can try to look for the statistics of these atoms. And this green curve here is an attempt to fit a Poisson law on the atom statistics. So for this 0 and 1 probability, one would expect that 2-atom probability, and clearly nothing is there. So we have no 2 atoms. two atoms are disappear. They are not here. And then it's actually it's very convenient because it means that as soon as we have one atom, we are sure to have only one, never two. So it's some kind of deterministic loading of a single atom. If it shines up, it's one. It cannot be two. So it's interesting, but it must be explained. So if we summarize what we see, actually, in the experiment, if we make this histogram, if we integrate the histogram, what we see is that the probability to have either zero or one atom is about the same and about 0.5, therefore, and it's impossible to have more atoms. So it means that an average number of atoms, which is 0.5, a variance, which is that value, which means that it's a strongly sub-Poissonian effect, it's a 3 dB squeezing, the number of atoms fluctuates less than Poisson. So how to explain that? You can do a completely trivial model, which works perfectly. It's enough to assume that when an atom enters a trap, if the trap is empty, the atoms stay there. If there is only one atom, both atoms go away. Which means that as soon as you introduce a new atom, the result is that it goes back to zero, because there is basically a collision which just makes that the two atoms get a lot of energy and escape from the trap. So if you make some little calculation from this simple model, you just recover the same results. This predicts trivially, it's a very simple calculation, that the probability are equal to 1/2, that it is impossible to get more two atoms, since as soon as the second one arrives, both go away. And there is also a very specific prediction, which is what will happen if I put more and more atoms? What will happen is that each new atom will bring the system back to zero. Therefore, the lifetime of the plateaus that I showed before should get shorter and shorter when I increase the number of atoms. When I try to put more atoms, I never get two. I just make the thing blink faster and faster. So this is a simple prediction which can be checked experimentally. When I simply to measure the lifetime of these plateaus by measuring the autocorrelation of the fluorescence light, and the duration of the plateau should shrink when you try to put more atoms. So we did that, and it works perfectly. This is the autocorrelation of the light of the plateaus on a log scale as a function of the loading rate. So we change the loading rate by increasing the magnetic field of the magneto-optical traps. That is, there are more and more fields, and basically, there are more and more atoms around, and therefore, the probability of loading goes up. So here is the minimum loading. We get lifetime, which are in the second range. And when we increase the loading, it just goes down by several orders of magnitude, down to typically 10 milliseconds. And then here, when it fluctuates that fast, actually, we cannot follow it anymore with our counting system. And on the other hand, if you look at the occupation probability, so here, it's the probability of one atom is small, but after that, it locks on 0.5. So on all that range of filling rates, it's always 0.5. It's just swapping faster and faster between 0 and 5, 0 and 1. Well, so this is nice. Again, it's not, is it, what is new in that thing? It's interesting to try to understand, is there a new type of collision? Is there a new type of, what is new? So it's very simple to understand also that we took the standard equation for describing the number of atoms in a trap. You have basically in presence of collision. So N is the number of trapped atoms. The derivative of N is the loading rate that we control externally, minus the one-body decay, the probability to an atom gets out. And this is this value, which is basically determined by collisions with background gas. So sometimes our vacuum is not that good, and sometimes there is a very fast atom, helium or water, which bumps into the atom and it goes away. So I call that a one-body decay. And this is it corresponds to 5 seconds in our trap. Now you have two body decays, which are collisions between two atoms in the trap, which are given by this expression. And so this two body decay has been studied in detail, for instance, by Carl Wieman, and there are values in the book, so in paper. So we just take these values, we plug these values in this equation, and there is a point, important point, since here, I'm using atom numbers, then this value of beta depends on the size of the trap. The smaller the trap, the larger beta. There is a corresponding to the fixed collisional value. This beta as a function of the atom number, it should be fixed as a function of the density, but as a function of the atom number, beta is increasing when the volume is decreasing. Now I can get some simple prediction from this model. I just calculate the average number of atoms. So if the and I want to represent the number of atoms as a function of the loading rate. So if the loading rate is very small, you can forget about collisions, and you just get that n is r naught over gamma. So it's a line. So it's a log-log scale, you see here. So it's a line, it's increasing. Now when you have very strong collisions, you can, that is a strong loading rate, you can forget about the linear term, and you get a number of atoms which is square root of r naught over beta. So the only thing that you have is a change in the slope. So this is a standard behavior that many, many people have seen. But now let us assume that we decrease the volume. Then beta will increase. So basically, this curve will go down. And at some point, it will cut one atom. But when it cuts one atom, you cannot have any more collisions. There is no collision between one and zero. So what happens? You get something like that. When the average number of atoms reach 0.5, there is a little gap that opens here. Because it's impossible for the collisions to bring the number of atoms, the average number of atoms, below 0.5. Because the collisional term, actually, when n is discrete, if n is equal to 1, this term is strictly 0. So the result is that you have a small gap here. So this is for a 5 micron trap. And now if you go to a 0.5 micron trap, the gap is huge. It extends over 3 orders of magnitude in loading rate. So it means if you start with a very low loading rate, it increases, and then it locks on 0.5. And you increase, and when you are increased by a factor about 1,000, then it starts increasing again. So this is what we call collisional blockade. This is a big gap which opens just because in our trap, the collision mechanism becomes the dominant mechanism as soon as there are 2 atoms in the trap, which is just a result of the size. So the physics of the collision is unchanged. It's exactly the same collision that are well known, but they become extremely, the contribution becomes extremely large just because the trap is extremely small. Okay, so now, yes, it's interesting also to see, can we see that regime? So we can. We just overload the trap, and we see something like that. So now, yes, when we overload the trap, we cannot, you have to realize that when we put more and more atoms, the time, storage time of one atom is shorter and shorter. So if we want to follow what is going on, we have to reduce the counting time. So previously it was 10 milliseconds, now it has been reduced by a factor 20 to 0.5 milliseconds. So this is a no trap peak, and what we see now is something like that, which means that actually we do not resolve anymore single atoms. And we may try to fit a Poisson law on these curves, and it does not work well. But we can also to fit a compound Poisson law, which is to assume that we have a given number of atoms that emit a given number of photons per atom. And now this fits perfectly. And from that curve, we can deduce a number of atoms and the number of photons per atom. And here, for instance, we get 9 atoms emitting each 3 photons during the counting time. And it's very robust. And we can even be more sure that it's right, because if we just rescale the number of photons using the counting time to the previous experiment, we find exactly the same value. So this gives the correct number of photons per atom, and therefore we are pretty sure that also the number of atoms is good, which means that we have a 9 atom average in the trap. So this shows that we have seen all 3 regimes. First, a weak loading regime, where the trap lifetime is essentially limited by collision with background gas. Then a very long collisional blockade regime, where the number of atoms is locked, the average number is locked on 0.5. So while the lifetime is decreasing by three orders of magnitude. And then finally, the strong loading, where we can overcome this blockade, and then overload the trap. So everything is obtained with MOT plus dipole trap. So both light beams, laser beams are there, and both are useful to create these very efficient collisions. Now, what we can do is that when we see one atom, we turn off the dipole trap. So we keep only one atom or several atoms in the dipole trap alone. And then we have measured the lifetimes, which are typically a few seconds, which correspond to the, again, to the residual pressure limit. So it's a background gas limited. By improving the vacuum, we might improve this value to, we think, up to tens or typically minutes, which are BEC type vacuum. How much time do I? Sorry?
10.
10 minutes, okay. Okay, so this shows clearly that we are able to trap single atoms. We more or less understand what's going on in our micro trap. But if we want to do something like quantum computing, let's say a gate, we need at least two atoms. They are hardly in the same trap, but it's pretty easy actually to make two traps. That is to have a double tweezer. The idea is that we have this optics, and we can just add a second laser beam like that, and then we will get two traps. And in each trap, we can put one atom. So then we have a screw here, and by just rotating this screw, we can move the atom around. So this is how it looks. This is the optical fibers that brings the main laser. The red light here is a laser. That is, it's added. It's not the true laser. This is a vacuum window, and here this is the entrance of the objective. So this makes one trap. So for the other trap, we add another fiber that is here, and there is some lens. Should come, yes. So this is a second beam, which goes at a small angle with the first one. And if you come to the lab and rotate this knob, you will have one atom at your fingertip that you can move as you wish. So with a double trap, we get basically two spots. Here, and here the distance is adjusted so that the two spots are 4 microns away. Again, each pixel is adjusted to be 1 micron in the atom plane. So we can get either no atom, one atom on the right, one on the left, two atoms. And here we are, this is a little movie, it's a real-time movie again, where we are rotating the knob so that we just move the two traps apart. And it's done by a student in real time. So you see it's pretty easy to carry a single atom alone. So here it's done in a little bit of overloading regime, which means that the atoms are going in and out faster than the integration time of the CCD camera. So it looks like if there is only always one atom, but actually just blinking very fast, so fast that you cannot see. That is that the CCD camera cannot see it because the integration time is too long. But still, the integration time here of the CCD, you see each frame, it's probably, I think, 2.2 seconds per frame. So it just means that this control of the distance of between the two atoms is extremely easy. Okay, so now we thought about coupling the two atoms. So this here it gets more difficult. So there are some proposals in the literature, many proposals. So we looked in some details to this one, which is from the Innsbruck group, that the idea is that we have our two atoms, typically separated by 3 microns. We can use as qubits ground states. We can drive these qubits using Raman transition here. This would be the coherent driving of a single qubit on each side. We can address individually each atom. And if we want to make a gate, the idea of the gate is to send on each atom, or on both atoms actually, a pulse of blue lights, which excites only one of these ground states, this one. So if the atom is in this ground state, it will go to an excited Rydberg state, and then there is a very strong large distance coupling between the two atoms. So you have to design this blue pulse so that the atoms make a 2π pulse. It goes up and back. And if both atoms go up, then the wave function gets a minus one here, which is a conditional phase shift gate, which is a basis for C0 if you use also single atom rotations. So the idea is pretty simple. You have your two atoms. You make a blue pulse, which makes a 2π rotation. And this 2π rotation, due to the very strong dipole-dipole coupling here, introduce the required pi phase shift here. So there are all details are in this paper. We try to adapt this thing to our setup. And you see that you have to run in a lot of compromise, all tricky. Basically, the coupling is a 1 over R cube coupling between the two Rydberg states. So for instance, you have to choose between having the atom very close or very far. So in the original paper, the distance was 0.3 microns. So in that case, the dipole-dipole coupling is extremely strong, and you can aim at 10 nanosecond switching time. But if you are just 10 times further apart, the coupling drops by 1,000. Which means that the switching time is more in the microsecond range. Now you have to choose also of exciting the transition resonantly, which is easy but extremely sensitive to the distance, or non-resonantly, which is not sensitive to the distance but which requires more powerful laser. You have also to choose the level and so on. So the typical results are summarized here, for instance. So this is the interatomic distance. And these are the main parameters: the trap power that you can read here, the blue pulse power you can read it here also, and the switching time in microseconds. So a good values would be here, for instance, which correspond to a distance which is about 1.3 microns, a trap power which is 2 milliwatts, which is more or less okay, a peak power for the pulse 2 watts, it's okay also, and a switching time about 2 microseconds. So these orders of magnitude are more or less right. But still, this experiment is extremely difficult to do. I will skip the details. OK, so this is my conclusion. So we were able to make a dipole trap with an extremely small trapping volume, a few cubic microns. We can store atoms for typically 2 seconds up to 15. The present record is 20. And we are able to choose some kind of number of atoms, but what is interesting is that the one atom regime is extremely stable over a very large range of loading rates. It's easy to make multiple dipole trap. It can be it's scalable up to 4, and we can implement a Raman scheme. Now we are looking for implementing Raman scheme for both driving qubits. This is required, and also doing Raman cooling, as was discussed by Rainer Blatt in his talk. Up to now, this is very similar to Rainer's talk, actually. You see that we have now a way to control neutral atoms, which looks a little bit like what people were able to do with ions for many years. There is a very specific thing to neutral atoms that ion people do not have, that are these nanoclouds. Having 10 atoms in the same cubic micron is a nice system, which is obviously impossible for ions. It would just blow up due to Coulomb interaction. But here, it's very easy to get. What we can do with it, I don't know yet. But I think it's an interesting system. OK, thank you for your attention. Yes, yes.
Now, Coulomb blockade gives you, I think it can in principle give you sort of 100% certainty that you will have, let's say, trapped an electron at a certain point.
Yes.
You have a finite variance in the numbers.
Yes, the idea that when you look at the equation, you have to decide whether the collisional terms takes out one atom or two atoms. If the collisional terms takes out one atom, you lock on one. If it takes out two atoms, it locks on 0.5. And so our results are fully consistent with the idea that each collision ejects both atoms. if we were changing the collision in such a way so that only one atom goes away, it's a billiard ball effect. So but the billiard ball is that if you have an atom here, and it makes that. If we were able to do that, it would log on one.
But there will always be random in the number of atoms.
No.
It will be zero or one.
No. If you do the calculation with a simple model, assuming that the collision ejects only one atom, it's very simple to see that it locks on one. Basically, it just means that there is always one. And if you put one more and more, it just means that each one gets out the other. And then it locks on one. So it's a question of whether the collision takes out two atoms or one atom, which decides that we have swapping between zero and one or locking on one. This is purely a billiard ball effect. So. Yes? Yes, certainly. That is, first, when we turn off the MOT, the collision cross-section drops by a factor about 1,000. So this very strong effect just cancels as soon as we turn off the MOT. This was already observed by Weimann. It's a very typical effect. When you have a dipole trap inside the MOT, as long as the MOT is on, you have a huge collision cross-section, and it goes down by three orders of magnitude when you turn off the MOT. Now, after that, you have collision inside the dipole traps, which are a more tricky problem that was studied by many people also. But it's much lower anyway. And then it depends on the amount of light. If the atoms are almost always in the ground state, then you have ground state collision similar to BEC type stuff, which are elastic collisions. These ones are nice. Yes? Yes, this is I saw that. That's when we have more atoms. Yeah, well, no, a few more. I saw the curve. Well, still one more. Ah, a few more. Ah, okay, that's it. So this is when we have 10 atoms. So the amount of light here, which is due to the dipole trap, looks smaller, but it's because our counting time was strongly reduced. If we rescale to the same counting time, we just have 9 times more light because we have 9 atoms, which is a simple. There is no surprise. It just fits as expected.
Yes. But since there are finite wave packets, do you have any idea?
Well, in this calculation, we more or less ignored all motional effects, which is a big approximation, actually. And then there is a strong dependency on the atom's temperature. It's whether, presently, our atoms are not cooled to the ground state. So they are basically moving in each trap. So when I speak about sensitivity to the motion, I assume that the atoms are not cooled. That is, they are just moving. So it means from one shot to another one, the distance may change. It's just, again, classical motion. Now, if you are able to cool them down, then you are in a quantum regime. And then you have to really take into account not only classical motion, but wave packet size. And we did not do that yet. But there are all kinds of problems which are related to the atomic motion in that process. Yes. This was a little bit discussed by the paper in the Zoller's group. Yeah?
The collisions that you're seeing are due to photo association.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We think it's a mixture of process, photo association, radiative escape, and maybe spin changing collisions.
The rate that you see is the rate as if they were reality. Is that correct? The beta
value, we can use the same as Weimann used.
So you don't see any effects due to the confinement, that is to say, the fact that the relative coordinate distribution is different when you have to show tightly confined.
I think we do not really have the accuracy to claim that. what we say is that if we use Weimann, the standard big trap value, it fits within a factor of 10, let's say. and doing more accurate measurement, we don't have the accuracy to say whether the it seems that you don't. Initially, we were thinking about some kind of special type of collisions, but it seems it's not required. It's just standard collision in a small volume.
Play with presence or absence of an atom or two in one or two traps, but where are the coherencies that would be needed for quantum computation?
They are created by the excitation, because as soon as the atoms are apart, as long as they are apart, their coupling is very weak. So we have to excite them. Okay, yeah, apps went back here. So the idea that when the atoms are up there, then they have this strong dipole-dipole interaction, and at this point, this interaction is state-dependent. Because if both atoms are excited, the 2 pi, the rotation, will create a different phase shift from one when one atom is excited or no atom is excited. So all the trick is the fact that the atoms, they get a very strong long-distance coupling when they are up there. And this creates a nonlinearity, which is responsible for the conditional phase. So this creates a coherence.